and being reminded, this is hell. Coming up on This Is Hell, how capitalism undermines our relationship with nature, leading to environmental destruction. More of your answers to this week's question from hell. I'm your bitter, blind, broke, gap-tooth radio show podcast live streaming host, Chuck Mertz. Producing is Alex Jerry. The planet's on fire. So yes, this is hell. There have been concerns about capitalism's impact on the environment for a very, very long time, dating back to the first half of the 19th century, after less than a century of capitalism. Here to explain how capital ruined our relationship with nature, sociologist John Bellamy Foster is co-author with Brett Clark of The Robbery of Nature, Capitalism and the Ecological Rift. Welcome to This Is Hell, John.
Glad to be here.
Oh, it sounds great. No static. That's fantastic. John is editor of Monthly Review, and you can find the Monthly Review online at monthlyreview.org. You can find out more about John at his website, johnbellamyfoster.org. Citing Marx, you explain Karl Marx's famous theory of metabolic rift. In his perspective, in this perspective, the labor process constitutes the vital social metabolism, mediating the relationship between humanity and the universal metabolism of nature, that is, natural processes as a whole. Capitalist commodity production, however, introduces an alienated mediation of this essential ecological relationship through its one-dimensional pursuit of the value form, exchange value, at the expense of the natural form, use value. The result is the metabolic rift. This requires a revolutionary reconstitution of society as a whole in order to restore a viable socio-ecological metabolism, one that will sustain the elemental conditions of life for the chain of human generations. Is the goal of capital to disconnect humanity from nature? Must capital disconnect us from nature to succeed?
Well, yes. The short answer is yes. The system is in many ways based on the exploitation of labor, but that requires the expropriation of the earth at the same time. The power of capital partly comes from the control of nature, from the robbery of nature. And the way the system works is that production, or the labor process, production for Marx was really the metabolism between human beings and nature. As we transform the earth through production and with all our social relations that are connected to that, we're altering our relations to nature. And capitalism does this in a particularly alienated way. Both the alienation of labor and the alienation of nature, of the earth, are connected. And I think that's what makes Marx's ecological analysis so important, because the economic critique of capital and the ecological critique of capital are, in his analysis, two sides of the same coin. We've generally looked only at one side of that coin. Now we're being forced to look at the other.
We're being forced to look at the other. Are we being forced to overcome that compartmentalization due to climate change?
Yes, and not just climate change. You know, we have to remember, I mean, climate change, of course, is our most immediate problem on a global level, but we have to understand, as the science explains, Earth system science now focuses on the creation of or the maintenance of a safe place for humanity, and in that context, they've described various planetary boundaries that we are crossing, all of which are close to a crossing, all of which represent planetary ecological crises. For example, species extinction or loss of biodiversity in general. We're in the sixth extinction, and we're destroying life at about 1,000 times the normal or background rate, extinguishing species. And there's ocean acidification. There's the destruction of the phosphorus and nitrogen cycles, which are destroying the oceans. There's loss of fresh water. There's loss of land cover, forests, and so on. And each of crossing each of these planetary boundaries is in itself a global ecological crisis. Each one of them could have irreparable and irreversible consequences for life and humanity. And we're doing all of this at the same time. And climate change is just one of these boundaries. And the common denominator of all of this is, of course, our economic system, which is putting the pressure on the Earth.
Well, so what happens then when environmentalists, when those who are fighting or trying to challenge climate change activists, what happens when they only look at the environmental aspect and not the economic aspect? Do they completely miss the point in how they can stop climate change? Because I constantly talk to people who are obviously against climate change, who are environmentalists, and very rarely do I hear them bring up the economics. So what happens when we only look at the environmental and not the economic?
Well, we end up being ineffective and incredibly wishful thinking. And when you think about it, there are really two kinds of denialism. One form of denialism is what we normally encounter when those like Trump and the oil companies and so on deny that climate change exists. And, of course, that's a problem. But a bigger problem for us than that kind of denialism, which really doesn't have that many adherents anymore, is a second kind of denialism. Maybe you could call it denialism of the relation of the problem to capitalism, to the economy. And in that kind of denialism, they think, oh, well, there is a climate change problem, and we'll just solve it by some marketplace solutions or some technological solutions that the system will automatically cough up, and we can just go along with our normal business. And that kind of denialism you find more among liberals and Democrats, and that's just as fatal. Maybe it's in some ways worse, because it's a case of those who admit there is a problem but thinks the problem doesn't really require any fundamental change. And that's one of the reasons why, we've known about the serious of climate change since the 1960s, certainly since the 1980s, and yet we've only made the situation worse, because there is a lack of understanding or willingness to understand the relationship between the climate change problem, the Earth system crisis, and capitalism.
There's another kind of denialism that I was thinking about, because you write right at the beginning of your book, you write about how what we need is a very long-term ecological change. How much denialism are we in right now that this is going to take a very, very, very long time to overcome the problems that have been caused by capitalism's impact on our planet through climate change?
Well, yeah, there's denialism of that. I talk in the book, or Brett Clark and I talk in the book about the long ecological revolution, which is the final chapter. But we tend to look at this in terms of two stages, because obviously we're in a very serious time crunch right now, because there's only about 14 years at the present rate of emissions before we hit 2 degrees Celsius increase in global average temperature, which the scientific consensus says is the point of no return the point of irreversibility. Essentially, if we get to 2 degrees Celsius increase in global average temperature, the whole climate is likely to spin out of control because of the various feedback mechanisms, and we won't be able to reverse things or stop things, or we won't be able to prevent the climate from going up to 3 degrees or 4 degrees. That's the great worry, and it's coming from the scientific community. So if we look at it that way, at our current rate of emissions, we only have, a very little time, decade and a half, and emissions have to peak now, according to all the projections, and then have to decrease globally by over 3% a year, which means in the rich countries it would have to decrease, practically speaking, by double digit per year. So obviously when we have this kind of situation, we can't simply talk about a long ecological revolution. We have to think in terms of two stages. We have to think of a stage of revolt that's motivated, that's revolutionary in character, but maybe more limited because we're starting from where we're at. And we have to keep the fossil fuel in the ground and do other necessary things, which would be, fundamental change. Then after that, if we can stabilize things so we don't go off the cliff, then we will have to make even bigger changes because our relation to the Earth is fundamentally different now. It's what they call a no analog situation in science. The Anthropocene, we have to stabilize our relation to the Earth, but we can't stabilize it under this system, which is based on the robbery of nature, exploitation of workers, and creates an anthropogenic rift or metabolic rift in the relation to the environment. We have to operate by some other kind of logic, some other kind of social logic, more sustainable and more egalitarian.
And that logic, as you point out towards the end of your book, is the logic that we've discussed on our show with Victor Wallace, who you thank at the beginning of your book, when we spoke with him about eco-socialism. Do you think are you seeing any signs that eco-socialism is making any headway, is gaining any ground, is growing in popularity here in the United States?
Well, there are various developments in the United States that are occurring. There is now a creation of a global and eco-socialism network, and they have a website, and you can look it up. There is system change, not climate change, in the United States. It seems like everywhere people are talking about eco-socialism. I actually think that Bernie Sanders' Green New Deal plan is really good. Yeah, I mean, it's astonishingly good, considering, and it's the only plan that there is that takes the issues fully into consideration, and it's very much eco-socialist in nature or eco-democratic in nature. It could be more radical, but it starts with the frontline communities. It focuses on the need to address the issue of labor in the context of addressing the climate problem. And it's on a scale that is meaningful. And none of the other plans that anywhere are like that, at least within the political universe. So there is an enormous growth of eco-socialist ideas. It's occurring very rapidly, but of course not fast enough, because we're speeding towards the edge of the cliff, and our efforts, although they're multiplying, we really need something that is much more explosive at this point. I think Extinction Rebellion in Britain is way ahead of, in some ways, in terms of action, of the kinds of things that have generally been happening in the United States. And some of the indigenous struggles in Canada are also things that we should learn from.
So just so people know, we interviewed Victor Wallace back in July 2018, and you can should check out his book, Red Green Revolution, The Politics and Technology of Eco-Socialism. They can hear that interview at our website, thisishell.com. You write that you are not concerned simply with the robbing of nature, but also the robbing of the physical bases of human existence through various forms of oppression associated with class, race, gender, and imperialism. In extreme cases, this manifests itself as what Frederick Engels called social murder. Earlier this month, we spoke with sociologist Josh Syme, author of Bandage, Sort, and Hustle, Ambulance Crews on the Front Lines of Urban Suffering. On a ride along in a high crime and poverty stricken neighborhood, Josh witnesses the victim of a murder, but he argues we may also have witnessed what Frederick Engels calls social murder, capitalism's inevitable wasting of human life. The market yields and necessitates exploited, excluded, and precarious populations, workers, jobless, and the temporarily employed, that are all exposed to an array of bodily risks. A common refrain I've seen on social media, and I heard long before it before social media existed, from anti-communists, from those who oppose any sort of socialism whatsoever, is that communism killed 100 million people more than any ideology in world history. Is it even possible to determine the level of brutality of any ideology? And if so, how do the social murders committed by capitalism compare with the killings of any past ideologies?
Well, yeah, it's hard to calculate these things, but of course, what we can say is, let's say, since the Second World War, the United States has been the number one killer of people in the world. There's actually no question of that we've killed more people in wars by far than any other country. It's just a brute fact, and we're very destructive of human life. You have to look at what's happening internally in the United States. The life expectancy in the United States has declined for 3 years in a row, and this is quite amazing, because this is pretty unique to the United States, though Britain is showing similar symptoms. The rich, advanced industrial country is not supposed to see a decline in life expectancy. But there's no question of what is the reason for this, and it's characterized in economics as, in particular, as deaths by despair, and more people are basically killing themselves as a result of alcohol, opioid drugs and suicides, and these are just symptoms of the deeper crisis in the United States. These deaths by despair have risen so rapidly that they've brought down the U.S. life expectancy 3 years in a row. And I think it's just the surface of deeper problems. Of course, these deaths by despair are mostly it's centered most heavily in white men who have seen, for various reasons, the decline in their position, which we could talk about. But it's also there have also been the long history of deaths by despair of similar kinds of problems affecting the Black and Latino community. It's simply that white men are joining that demographic in some ways, and this is, I think, a really serious sign of the fact that this nation is, in some ways, coming apart, and it's part of a larger global crisis, and we have to turn it around.
We are speaking with sociologist John Bellamy Foster, co-author with Brett Clark of The Robbery of Nature, Capitalism and the Ecological Rift. John is editor at Monthly Review. You can find out more about Monthly Review online at monthlyreview.org. And you can find out more about John at his own website, johnbellamyfoster.org. You quote the celebrated German chemist Justus von Liebig, writing in the late 1850s and early 1860s that a farmer may sell and permanently alienate all that portion of the produce of his farm, which has been supplied by the atmosphere, but not the constituents of the soil. A field from which something is permanently taken away cannot possibly increase or even continue equal in productive value. He stressed that the axiom thus enunciated is simply a natural law. And later you explained Liebig's famous law of the minimum, moreover, indicated that there was a complex balance of soil nutrients such that to enhance the productivity of the soil in a given area, it was necessary to supply the nutrient in which the soil was most deficient, to the point at which that nutrient was once again in proportion with the next most deficient soil mineral. Soil exhaustion meant that the mineral composition of the earth had been so compromised that nutrients needed to be massively imported by the hand of man from outside the farm. Liebig writes, in this sense, most of our cultivated fields are exhausted, requiring massive infusions of chemical nutrients from outside. Does capital insist on massive amounts of chemicals in the environment? Can capitalism be green?
Well, yeah, no, it can't. It made me think of how we turn our water green with chemicals. But the analysis of Liebig was very important. His notion of nutrient cycling, and it was what led to Marx's notion of the metabolic rift, or the rift in the metabolism between human beings and nature. And Liebig explained that we were basically robbing the soil of nutrients by shipping food and fiber hundreds and thousands of miles, and then not returning the nutrients to the earth, and the earth was being exhausted, the soils being exhausted as a result. In Liebig's time, in Marx and Liebig's time in the mid 19th century, they tried to compensate this for Britain and the United States and so on by shipping guano bird droppings from Peru to England, and by raiding the Napoleonic battlefields and the catacombs of Europe for bones to put on English fields. And this was the beginning of the growth of the fertilizer industry to try to compensate for the robbing of the soil. And of course, we've gone to different stages with that now, but we now pour, you know, nitrogen and phosphorus fertilizers on our soil. We have all of this runoff from these chemicals that are destroying our lakes, our rivers, the ocean, and in terms of phosphorus, phosphorus mining is dangerous and damaging, and there's a limit on the amount of phosphorus. Anyway, these are complex systemic problems, but it's by focusing on this issue of nutrient cycling and that the notion of the metabolism of nature and society came to the fore, and Marx introduced the notion of social metabolism. And it was out of this analysis that ecological theory and ecosystem theory was to evolve. I've written another book on the whole history of this called The Return of Nature that's coming out in the spring. But this was the beginning of ecological analysis, and basically Liebig said you can't simply take from the earth, you have to restore, you have to replenish. I think most people can understand that, but it's amazing how little we talk about that issue in our society, because we have a sort of a capitalist robbery culture. We can take infinitely from the earth without putting back and not suffer the repercussions. But now we are seeing we are suffering the repercussions, and we're suffering them on a planetary scale.
You write that Liebig was not alone from the 1850s to the 1870s in addressing the issue of the destructive relation to the soil. Other major natural scientists, agronomists, political economists raised the same questions, including George Waring, Henry Carey, James F.W. Johnston, Karl Frost, and Wilhelm George Friedrich Roscher, all of whom, except Waring, Marx studied closely. So we can include Marx in that group, too. So there's all these people discussing it in the mid-1850s, a century before we had the Green Revolution that was far more dependent on chemicals and agriculture, nearly 150 years before the conglomeration of big agriculture in the late 20th century and going on until today. Was there a huge debate over what capitalism meant for the future in the 1850s? Because that would refute any claim by capitalism apologists who argue that nobody saw this coming. Nobody knew that we are innocent in the destruction of our planet by capitalism because nobody ever thought that would happen. So to what extent did we simply not know that capitalism could be so destructive that it could destroy the soil, cause famines, poison the environment with chemicals leading to cancer, especially in children's, and be a direct path to climate change? To what extent was that actually being debated? And to what extent can we just say we just didn't see this coming?
Well, we did see it coming, or it was being debated, not necessarily in the public realm, but among scientists, among socialists. And in our book, we have the Rift of Ire is the second chapter. It's a chapter about Ireland, and it's about the discussion someone went on about the ecological destruction of Ireland and how it came about and how it was related to British colonialism. And as Marx said, robbing of Ireland's, the British robbing of Ireland's soil. And all of those things were going on at the time. But of course, like today, the main media of those days didn't highlight the contradictions. Example I could give is E. Ray Lankester, who was the leading scientist in England, the leading zoologist, biologist in England in the generation after Darwin and Huxley. And he was also a friend of Karl Marx. Lankester is unusually was he was a protege of Charles Darwin and a friend of Karl Marx, and he's the only person we know that was at both Darwin's funeral and at Marx's funeral. And he was very influenced by Marx's ecological thinking, I believe. He was certainly a very strong critic of capitalism and a socialist himself, but he was also the leading British scientist of the day, at least within the biological sciences. And he was an enormous critic of capitalism and its destruction of the environment. So, and his father was actually, his father was also a contemporary of Marx and was one of the leading individuals in fighting diseases engendered by capitalism, what Engels called social murder. So there were people at the time, and E. Ray Lankester wrote scathing critiques of the way we were carrying out the extinction of other species and the basis in capitalism. And this went forward to other thinkers. This is a story I tell in The Return of Nature, which basically deals with a century after the death of Marx and Darwin, and how socialists played enormous role in the construction of ecology and the most radical and innovative aspects of ecology. So we knew about these problems, but in some ways it was separated from the movements. Like I said, the problem in Marx's, we could see the problem in Marx's view as kind of two sides of a coin, economic exploitation, economic crisis is one side of the coin, ecological crisis, robbery of the earth is the other. This evolved in Marx's analysis, but we tended in our movements to look at one side of the coin only and not put it together.
You explain how this modern robbery culture based on the total alienation of the soil was the antithesis of a rational agriculture rooted in the application of science. Last night, I mistakenly started watching a town hall with Bernie Sanders, and he started talking about climate change. And he said that one of the things that they were going to be addressing, unlike the Trump administration, is climate change through a process of science. So a lot of people are saying that, hey, Donald Trump is opposed to science. This is, you know, these Republicans are against science. What do we miss when we don't understand that it seemingly capitalism is opposed to science?
Yeah, I think that it was particularly the problem of the metabolic rift that led Marx to conclude that a rational application of science under capitalism was not possible. And the other radical scientists who played such a big role in constructing ecology came to similar conclusions. Of course, we have to argue for the rational application of science. We have to take science seriously, but capitalism tends to corrupt science because the pursuit of profit always comes before people on the planet. And because it's an alienated system, and so many of the scientists, you know, who are caught up in the economic system and the power system too, end up serving that alienated system, those alienated mediations. But nonetheless, we have to put a great deal of our hope in science as well as in art as the two main intellectual endeavors of human beings in order to counter this. And so I guess the answer is, yeah, rational application of science under capitalism is impossible, but there are degrees, and we can certainly go against the logic of capitalism in the present, follow the logic of science rather than the logic of capitalism as a means of stabilizing our relation to the earth and preventing the social murder of so much of humanity and the alienation of humanity. We have to go against in the direction of the logic of science and the logic of art and against the logic of capitalism. And even in the present day, I think we can do that. But the fuller revolution will come even later. Revolution occurs in stages that mount in scale as you go forward.
So was Marx an environmentalist who was predicting climate change?
No. He didn't. I mean, they didn't know about climate change at the time. It's interesting, though, while Marx was so much up on the science of his time, that when John Tyndall the great British physicist, when he was presenting his in lectures in London, when he was presenting the results of his experiments that showed that carbon dioxide was a greenhouse gas. Marx, we don't know if he was there at those lectures, but we know he was attending Tyndall's lectures at the time. And that's sort of symbolic of how much he was involved in it. He was involved in he took notes on the effects of climate change from a paleoclimatic standpoint, looking at how the isotherms shifted and caused species extinction. So he was right on top of things in his time, but they didn't actually have a notion of global warming until the 1890s, and even then it didn't even in 1938, Callender was presenting the notion of global warming prominently to British associations or meteorological associations, and almost the whole scientific community rejected it. So it took a while before we actually knew about these things. But Marx was looking at it. He was looking at the contradictions. And the British scientist J.B.S. Haldane, who was a Marxist, wrote one of the earliest pieces for Nature on carbon dioxide increase in the atmosphere, one of the most reliable early estimates we have in 1936. So the radical scientists influenced by Marxism and dialectics were very, very much involved in this, but we didn't really see global warming as a problem. It wasn't even really recognized as a serious problem until about 1962 with the calculations of Budiko in the Soviet Union. That was the breakthrough.
You write that it is precisely because Marx offered a conception of a future society beyond capitalism directed to sustainable human development in which the associated producers would rationally regulate the metabolism between nature and society that his views can be said to have fallen short of those who can be considered ecologically conscious persons in the modern sense. The implication is that modern green thinkers, by definition, see ecological devastation as unconditional and hence wholly insurmountable and are inherently pessimistic and apocalyptic, conceiving of no way forward for humanity, at least if this requires a break with the existing social order. This is no doubt an accurate description of the views of most mainstream environmentalists today, who categorically refuse to consider any solution that involves going beyond capitalist relations of productions. To you, what explains that refusal? What explains that capital denialism within the environmental movement?
Well, yeah, it's hard to... hard to explain, but maybe we should it's what we should expect. First of all, the mainstream environmental movement, a large part of it gets funding from corporations, so they're very reformist organizations at best. They're not necessarily coming from a very radical perspective or a worker-oriented perspective, or they're not geared to fundamental change. They realize that there are environmental problems, but they tend to really emphasize the degree of the problem when they're asking for money from the public, and they say, well, you know, and then they, but in terms of their actions, They act as though we have all the time in the world, that capitalism will solve the problem. And we have a problem in our society where, you know, the reality for most people, and it has to do how alienated we are from the earth, for the reality for most people is their material conditions seem to be determined by their economic income, by their jobs, their, you know, whatever form of income you have, wages or profits or so on. We live by going to the stores and buying products. We pay our taxes. Everything is survival is entirely about our income, and we think of our reality as economic. And yet, underlying this is an ecological issue, the deeper level of material existence. Which maybe scientists deal with, but ordinary people in our society, especially urban in the urban environment, they don't deal with ecological questions. They seem distant to them, and this sort of feeds into a kind of general denialism, a failure to look at the roots of things. Being radical means going to the roots. And it used to be that in socialist circles, going to the roots meant looking at economic exploitation, and we need to do that. But we also have to look at the ecological roots. We have to look at how the exploitation of humanity and the alienation of labor is tied to the expropriation of the earth and the robbery of nature, and how this is all systemic. And this is a place that people generally haven't gotten to, but the seriousness of the crisis may force it upon us. One thing, I wrote a book, The Vulnerable Planet, in 1994, and I was criticized at this time by people like even David Harvey for saying that we were facing a global, a planetary ecological crisis. And I realized that my analysis had been based on two things. One was paying attention to what the scientists were saying, but also coupling that with a knowledge of capitalism, which the natural scientists didn't really have. And when you put the two together, you could see just how vicious a spiral we were in.
Well, I am sorry that you were correct. I wish you weren't correct in that prediction. We have been speaking with sociologist John Bellamy Foster, co-author with Brett Clark of The Robbery of Nature, Capitalism and the Ecological Rift. This spring, he's going to be releasing a new book called Return to Nature. And John, I hope that you return to our show to talk about Return to Nature, because I've really, really enjoyed our conversation this morning. We've got one last question for you, John, and what we do with all of our guests, our final question is what we call the question from hell, the question we hate to ask, you might hate to answer, our audience is going to hate your response. Did we choose capitalism, and is it at least better than what preceded it?
Well, I should say the book is The Return of Nature, and yes, capitalism, I think, was preferable to feudalism. It was better than what preceded it, and if you look at all the indicators like life expectancy and famines and so on, it was better than what preceded it in many ways. There are things that were lost, though. As William Morris always tells us, the labor used to be mingled with art, that was destroyed, and you could see the alienation of labor, which was created by capitalism. So, like most things in history, it was sort of a, you know, we have this spiral development. It's both an advance and a retrogression, right? We're now looking at a kind of maybe a spiral development where we really have a choice between ruin and revolution. And we have to pull forward values, socialist values, egalitarian values, ecological values that have all been suppressed by the system. And these are just basically human values. We need a rise of humanity to cope with this problem. And a lot of the answers to the ecological problem are here. I mean, we know what to do. And a lot of our answers, in fact, lie in our past, which we have to retrieve in order to revolutionize the present. So I think we can do all of this, and I don't know if we will succeed, but I do know that hundreds of millions, maybe even billions of people will be engaged in the struggle, and I know what side I'm on.
We've been speaking with John Bellamy Foster. You can find out more about John at his own website, johnbellamyfoster.org. His new book coming out this spring is Return of Nature, and you can find out more about that at monthlyreview.org, where he is an editor. Thank you so much for being on our show. This is a pleasure and an honor to have you on the show, sir. This is a fascinating book. And just so our listeners know, we didn't even skim the surface of this book. There's so much more to this book than what we just had in a 45-minute conversation. So please check out John's writing at monthlyreview.org. Check out his book, The Robbery of Nature, Capitalism, the Ecological Rift, and look forward to his book, Return of Nature. Thank you so much for being on our show this week.
Thank you very much.
Bringing you bong-hitting journalism since 1996, this is Hell. This week's question from Hell is, what nice thing are you saying about Michael Bloomberg after you cash his check? Our favorite answer gets a book that we are featuring on tomorrow's show, Margaret Kimberly's Prejudential, Black America and the Presidents. You can leave your answer to this week's question from Hell at our Facebook page, facebook.com/thisishellradio, or email it to us, chuck@thisishell.com, alex@thisishell.com, or tweet it at us @thisishellradio. Alex, do you have any more answers to this week's question from Hell?
What nice thing are you saying about Michael Bloomberg after you cash that check? Alan G says, these bootstraps fit rather nicely and they really complement the rest of my wardrobe. Corey N says, how old is he and what's his risk factor for deadly disease? Corey, I said nice thing.
Exactly.
That check's not clear. And Walter M says, Walter M says, you have a better haircut than Chuck's.
He does. He does. Very nice haircut.
Luke H says, Mike Bloomberg's boots taste the best. Seamus R says, I actually feel lighter and healthier after selling my kidneys. It's very liberating. And finally, Mark A.S. says, Bloomberg never flew to Jeffrey Epstein's Lolita Island that we know of.
Alex will have the rest of the answers to this week's question from Hell, and we'll announce this week's winner on our show tomorrow, Thursday. Alex, who is on tomorrow's Thursday live show? I've mentioned it a couple of times, Margaret Kimberly, but...
Yeah, so you can't get sick, because we don't want to cancel on her again. She'll start to suspect something.
I know.
Kimberly will be on the show to talk about her book, Prejudential, Black America and the Presidents.
Tune in to tomorrow's show, streaming live at 10 a.m. Chicago time here at thisishell.com, or listen to the podcast posted shortly after our live stream to find out if you have won this week's question from Hell. I'm your bitter, blind, broke, gap-toothed radio show host, Chuck Mertz. Producing this week's show is Alex Jerry. I want to thank Alex. I want to thank John Bellamy Foster. Live from land stolen from the natives, this is Hell.
Thank you for listening to This Is Hell. For more interview hell and to support the show, visit thisishell.com.